Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. You could call Admiral James Stavridis the ultimate watcher. He's watched wars from the bridge of a Navy destroyer. As NATO Supreme Commander, he watched allies and adversaries jostle. He's studied empires, past and innovation today. And he keeps a close watch as China, Russia, India, and these United States aim for power and influence in the world of the future. This hour on Point, Admiral James Stavridis on geopolitics today. You can join us on air or online. How do you see this nation today and its place in the world? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Later this hour, a Nigerian writer tells Williams College graduates not to be complacent. We'll get to that later, but joining me first this hour from New York is James Stavridis, retired U.S. Navy admiral. He was commander of the U.S. Southern Command and later of the U.S. European Command and finally NATO's Supreme Allied Commander. Today, he is dean of Tufts University Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. He's out with a new book called Sea Power, The History of Geopolitics of the World's Oceans. And you can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Admiral, great to have you with us. Thank you.
Hi, Jane. Good to be underway with you.
Good to be underway, indeed. You know, it's tempting to think of sea power as an artifact of the past, that somehow the skies and the space and the World Wide Web are the new frontiers of geopolitical competition, of economic competition. What should we understand about the importance of sea power today?
Well, let's start with the oceans themselves. They cover 70% of the world. By the way, fun fact to know, Jane, 70% of your body is made out of water as well. And here's the key fact. 70% of the oxygen we breathe comes from photosynthesis that occurs at sea. Here's another fun fact. 95% of the world's trade moves by sea. At any given moment, 50,000 ships are underway, 3 to 5 million mariners at sea. So there's an enormous economic and ecological component to the importance of the sea. But what I also talk about in Sea Power is the geopolitics, how nations over centuries and even today are using the oceans with their military capability to create real influence. And we see that all around the world. Mm.
How has it affected American history that for the last couple of generations, the United States has had by far the world's most powerful Navy?
We have had the luxury since the end of the Soviet Union of operating on the oceans of the world as though they were just huge American lakes. That occurred because, A, the Soviets dissolved. Their Navy was broken apart literally or put into mothballs. And throughout much of these last two decades, China was an observer but didn't venture into deep blue water. Both of those things have changed over the last 5 years, almost 10 years now. We've seen a building program out of both Russia and China, and they challenge us today. We see Russia challenging us in the eastern Mediterranean off the coast of Syria. We see Russian ships intermingled with NATO ships in the Baltic Sea. We play Hunt for Red October under the Arctic ice. And China in the South China Sea is building artificial islands and challenging the very root of sovereignty of what should be considered the high seas there.
So what's the big picture lesson then from the history of naval power?
You know, I like the expression that big doors tend to swing on small hinges. You can look back in history and think about five or six sea battles as an example of huge geopolitics swinging on the hinge of a battle. 25 years ago, a place called Salamis, a bay outside of Athens, the Greeks defeat the Persians. Greece, democracy, Western values survive. 500 years ago, a place called Lepanto in the central Med, the Ottoman Empire, is defeated by a Catholic coalition, a Christian coalition. The Battle of Trafalgar, off the coast of Spain in the 1800s saves the United Kingdom from Napoleon. And in our own history, this week we mark the 75th anniversary, Jane, of the Battle of Midway, the iconic World War II battle in which the United States broke Japanese sea power and began to roll back Japanese advances. So the lesson is that sea power is fundamental to national power, and that's really what the book is about.
You mentioned Russia. You mentioned China. How will the rise of Russia's and China's naval power impact the United States?
Both Russia and China will seek to use their navies, Jane, to influence events around the world. So in the case of Russia, they will press against the borders of NATO, including in the Arctic, the high north. They'll attempt to gain influence in nations around those borders by operating their ships there. They will launch strikes and project power ashore, as we saw the Russians do, into Syria in support of the war criminal Assad. Or in the case of China at the other end of the earth, we'll see the Chinese operating their ships, building artificial islands, and literally claiming territory, huge chunks of territory in the South China Sea. In both cases, those are great powers using their navies to influence the overall structure of the global proposition that we've relied on really for centuries, but most recently since the end of the Cold War.
So talk about what China is doing more specifically in the South China Sea, building islands, militarizing this area, developing really tens of thousands of acres of land there. Do they claim that body of water?
They absolutely do. And to give them their due, they have laid out a case based on historical international law. And you can go back to the 1400s when Christopher Columbus is discovering America. He's in a 60-foot ship, the Niña, the Pinta, the Santa Maria. These were only about 60 feet. At that time, China is operating ships that are 400 feet long, four deckers with 500 mariners in them under a eunuch admiral, probably not the kind of admiral you want to be. His name was Zheng He. And the Chinese were able to explore these waters. So they lay out a case that these have historically been Chinese waters. The problem is, in the intervening centuries, so many different things have happened. So many different nations appropriately claim chunks of the South China Sea. So they took the case to the international court and they lost. But they refuse to recognize that. They continue to build islands. They continue to militarize. They'll try and play the long game to claim those waters.
So they're essentially building airstrips, right, in the middle of the South China Sea. So it makes me think, do we have allies there pushing back against China in this region? Or is it just the United States? What are we doing about this?
We have an excellent network of allies in Asia, starting with Japan, which has the third best navy in the region after the United States and China. South Korea has a very capable navy. Australia, a very good navy. New Zealand, small but professional maritime security forces. Singapore, a small city-state, if you will, a very capable maritime force. These are allies. We also have friends like India, who operates ships all the way into the Pacific, Malaysia, Vietnam, the Philippines. We've had a bit of a disagreement lately since President Duterte took power. But I think overall, we have a very capable network, and that will be part of maintaining American sea power in the region.
So you mentioned South China Sea. You mentioned the Baltics. What, to your mind, are the big maritime hotspots that we should be worrying about in the world today?
I think there are three. The first we've just discussed, the South China Sea, where while I don't predict a war with China, I think our interests coincide, broadly speaking, with China. But I do see continuing shoulder bumping and controversy and possibly leading up to an exchange of not ordnance but ships banging against each other. So a lot of tension in the South China Sea. Secondly, the Eastern Mediterranean off the coast of Syria, where Russia operates a great many ships and flows them south from the Black Sea north of Istanbul and operates from bases in Syria, while U.S. ships are also there in support of our operations against the Islamic State, while the Russian ships are there to support the war criminal Assad. Those interests do not coincide. That could lead to difficulties. And the third and final I'll mention, Jane, is in the high north, in the Arctic, where Russia is investing greatly in Arctic bases. They're building icebreakers. The United States, Canada, Denmark, by virtue of Greenland, Iceland, Norway are on the other side of the Arctic Sea, all NATO countries. We need to avoid turning that into a zone of conflict, perhaps, pun intended, a Cold War. Let's avoid that. In fact, in all of these areas, I hasten to say, I think we have the tools of diplomacy to ensure we don't stumble into hot conflict. But if we don't pay attention, the odds are higher that we will.
Do we have our eye off the ball at this moment?
I think we do, particularly in the Arctic. The United States has only one icebreaker. The Russians operate dozens. The Chinese, who are obviously not an Arctic power, operate many more icebreakers than we do. What's happening there, Jane, is as global warming takes hold, the ice is melting, shipping lanes are opening, vast resources, hydrocarbons, are available, and we're going to see a kind of a great game of competition for territory, for sea control, for operations of these sea lanes of communication. And I don't think the United States is paying enough attention specifically to the high north, nor broadly to the oceans themselves. Again, back to the point of the book, Sea Power.
I'm not sure people realize, back to the Eastern Mediterranean, that Russia has a strategic asset in Syria, a Mediterranean Sea naval base on the coast of Syria that allows Russia to exercise military influence in that area.
They do indeed. And this is all part of Vladimir Putin's broad strategy for Russia, which is to press out around the edges, the littoral seas of Russia, as well as what is sometimes called the near abroad, those states around the perimeter of Russia. He seeks control and influence both ashore. This is what led to the invasion of Ukraine and the annexation of Crimea, and also at sea.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're speaking this hour with retired Admiral James Stavridis about history, power, and the future. And you can join the conversation. Do you see this president, President Trump, really shaking things up on the global stage? Here's some sound. The USS Dewey held a freedom of navigation operation in the South China Sea recently, sailing within 12 nautical miles of an artificial island built by China. Here's a Reuters report on that.
Ripples of tension between China and the United States on Thursday, Beijing's foreign ministry accusing Washington of damaging an improving situation in the South China Sea.
The U.S.'s actions bring severe disruptions to the process of negotiations and can only bring harm, not benefits.
Those stern words, a reference to a U.S. warship that sailed close to Mischief Reef a day earlier.
And here's Admiral Mark Ferguson, then the commander of U.S. Naval Forces Europe, telling CNN last year that Russia is deploying ballistic missiles and attack submarines to an extent not seen since the Cold War.
What we see in these operations, it's focused on protecting the maritime flanks of Russia, but also denying NATO the ability to operate within the maritime flanks as well. And I'm speaking of the Baltic Sea, the Black Sea, and areas in the far North Atlantic around Norway.
Admiral James Stavridis is my guest this hour. Admiral, a lot of smart scholars have said for years that we need to realign our alliances, that we should stop being the world's policeman. President Trump, in his often controversial way, seems to be doing that. I'm curious, does the president's America First assertion work for you?
It does not, as follows. I am not a triumphalist. I don't think the United States is the global superpower. I don't think we have the capability nor the desire to be the world's policeman. But we ought to be engaged in a leadership role in the world. Those are two, in my view, different things. And if we walk away from the world, if we follow that temptation to come home, depend on these big oceans to somehow protect us, be content that we have benign neighbors to north and south, and take this isolationist course forward, I think we do so at our peril, Jane. And here's my evidence. It is, let's go back 100 years ago to the end of World War I. The United States has an opportunity to lead, to be part of the League of Nations. We choose not to be. We take a deliberate isolationist strategy. We build walls called tariff barriers, the Hawley Smoot tariffs. How'd that all work out? Well, we cracked the global economy. We have a Great Depression. You can drop a plumb line from it into fascism in Europe, the rise of Nazi Germany, the rise of Mussolini's Italy, and we end up going back to Europe. We come out of that war and we take the opposite course, Jane. We invest in the Marshall Plan. We engage. We help rebuild. It's a tale of two outcomes. I think isolationism is not the path for our nation. On the other hand, no, we don't have to be the world's policeman. I'll conclude by saying that's why our allies, our alliance structure, our partners, our friends are so important to us, and a great deal of that partnership is manifest at sea.
So the U.S. needs to take a leadership role in the world. I hear you. Politics aside, what do you make of President Trump and how he is conducting himself in office?
Well, I'll stay on foreign policy. I'll simply observe that, Jane, probably 12 people in the country are listening to us right now because everyone else is listening to James Comey's testimony. But let's leave aside the spectacle, and it is a discouraging one, of a former FBI director and a president of the United States holding a war between themselves in front of the theater of the Congress. That's discouraging. But let's stay on the international world. I suppose with President Trump, I would say, you know, life is always compared to what? And compared to what he was talking about a year ago on the campaign trail, it's not so bad. A year ago, we were going to pull out of NATO. We were going to encourage Japan and South Korea to get nukes and protect themselves. We were going to have a beautiful friendship and partnership with Russia. We were going to build a huge wall on the southern border. We don't hear much about any of those things at the moment. Instead, the Trump administration has steered a reasonably stable course, and I attribute it to a good thing in the Trump administration, the selection of people like General Jim Mattis, SecDef, General John Kelly, Homeland Security, General H.R. McMaster, National Security Advisor, Secretary Rex Tillerson, global businessman as a Secretary of State. So it's not as bad as it could have been. There's still plenty I would argue with about what we're doing.
So at the beginning of this new administration, you know, with several ongoing investigations involving Russia, chronic leaking from the White House and intelligence agencies, policy reversals, and of course, the president tweeting. I mean, Trump supporters say, yes, he's shaking things up. But I'm curious, you, a distinguished admiral, at what point does all this tumult in Washington become destabilizing for the United States and for our allies around the world?
I think at the moment for our allies, it's more confusing than destabilizing. And they are still in the mode of let's wait and see. And in fairness, we're 4 months into a four-year term. So the first reaction from our allies is wait and see. The second is, well, let's watch what they actually do, not what they say they're going to do. But thirdly, and this is what worries me, you're starting to see signals of a sense that the United States is an unreliable ally, and thus the Europeans, for example, are saying, well, we'll have to find our own way in the world. Chancellor Angela Merkel talking about the kind of creaking and cracking of the transatlantic bridge. That's not a good thing. General Eisenhower, my vastly more distinguished predecessor as Supreme Allied Commander at NATO, said that the greatest geostrategic advantage of the United States is a unified Europe in partnership with us. We risk enormously geopolitically if that starts to drift away. Has not happened yet, but you can kind of see the outlines of that outcome. I hope we can avoid it.
Based on what you just said, I want to play this sound. In his May 25th address at the NATO headquarters, as the heads of state of the member nations looked on and looking pretty glum, President Trump criticized them for not paying their fair share for the defense umbrella.
These grave security concerns are the same reason that I have been very, very direct with Secretary Stoltenberg and members of the alliance in saying that NATO members must finally contribute their fair share and meet their financial obligations. But 23 of the 28 member nations are still not paying what they should be paying and what they are supposed to be paying for their defense.
And here was German Chancellor Angela Merkel at a campaign event in Munich after she and other NATO leaders, including President Trump, met in Brussels. She said the conference had changed the way she sees Europe's relationship with the United States. Here's a clip from that speech interpreted by Press TV.
The times in which we can fully count on others are somewhat over, as I've understood over the past few days. Therefore, I can only say that we Europeans must really take our destiny into our own hands. Of course, in friendship with the United States, in friendship with Great Britain, and in good neighborly relations, when possible, with Russia and other countries. But we should know that we have to fight for our future ourselves.
Pretty strong, Admiral Stavridis, saying Europe will go it alone if we have to. I mean, first of all, what do you make of that?
First of all, it is a natural human and political reaction on the part of Angela Merkel. If I can use a nautical metaphor, as the author of a book called Sea Power, I feel Europe drifting away from us. Secondly, I think President Trump has deeply offended the Europeans. And it's really not about how much they spend on defense at the end of the day. And frankly, we spend $600 billion a year. The Europeans spend $300 billion a year on defense. That's more than Russia and China combined. So they might be a bit short in a couple of areas, but broadly speaking, they're the second largest defense budget in the world, and they're the second most capable military in the world. So to stand in public and insult them, as opposed to closing the door, having the conversation, let's get you up to the 2% of GDP, that's legitimate. It's the style points. It's the notes of ill and unpleasantry that come across in that conversation. That doesn't help us over the long term. Angela Merkel's reaction fully justified.
I've written down here in capital letters, Europe drifting away from us, which is what you just said. What are the ramifications of that?
There can be no more geopolitically tragic event than a cracking, a weakening of the transatlantic bridge. Let's kind of do the numbers on NATO quickly. Here are 29 nations. We just added Montenegro. So 29 nations, 52% of the world's gross domestic product, 3 million men and women under arms, almost all of them volunteers, 24,000 military aircraft, 800 warships. This is a rich, powerful, cohesive, and value-aligned alliance. It is the ultimate force for good in the world. Over time, if that European component drifts away because of a lot of churlish behavior on the part of the United States, we will be poorer, we will have less alliance structure to fall back on, and the world will be less stable.
So broad strategic shifts, do you see those underway or do you just worry about that?
I see them underway, and we ought to recognize that almost immediately after Angela Merkel's statement, who arrived in Berlin to enormous acclaim, deep talks, it was President Xi of China. Like nature, geopolitics abhors a vacuum. The degree to which the United States steps out of the international world will be the degree to which China at the moment will step into it. U.S. and Chinese values do not align. They are not a democracy. Our objectives do not align in Asia. We have cyber disagreements with China that are profound. And so we don't want to cede that international space to the Chinese. Again, I don't predict we're going to have a war with them, but we will have competition. We need to make sure that we have allies, friends, and partners with us so we can help continue to move the world toward the right value set.
You're talking about Europe here. Let me move you to Qatar for a moment. In a series of tweets, President Trump this week took credit for Saudi Arabia's move to isolate its smaller neighbor, Qatar. America has a critical strategic relationship with that country. It has two major command posts there from which the U.S. conducts air wars on the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. What did you make of this action by the president this week?
I think that it is in the interest of the United States that the Sunni Arab world, which includes both Qatar and Saudi Arabia, UAE, Oman, etc., the Sunni world, operate together. That is a positive for the United States. Why? Because it helps us confront Iran, a Shia state that has both territorial and spiritual aspirations throughout the entire region. It helps us because we can then encourage Israel to work with these Sunni states, of course, Egypt being the most populous of all of them. That's good for Israel, our best ally in the region. And thirdly, geopolitically speaking, it creates stability in a zone from which the world still draws a great deal of its energy, its hydrocarbons. So for all those reasons, we should not be trying to encourage a schism in the Sunni world. And I noticed that the administration has backtracked on the, quote, taking credit for it, unquote, and is now talking about how can we help mediate this disagreement. That's a vastly better position for them to be in.
Here's a Reuters report on the mounting tensions among Sunni Arab nations this week as they ostracize the Gulf state of Qatar, led by Saudi Arabia. Here's that.
A simmering regional dispute boiling over Monday. Saudi Arabia joining Egypt, the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain in severing their ties with Qatar, reopening a festering wound just 2 weeks after U.S. President Donald Trump met Muslim leaders in Riyadh and took a hawkish line on Iran.
Admiral James Stavridis, Pentagon officials say they were taken aback by the president's tweets on this. Defense Secretary James Mattis, however, said, I'm positive there will be no implications coming out of this dramatic situation, end quote. How do you see it? Do you agree with General Mattis?
Nobody knows this region more intimately than Jim Mattis, who served as my opposite number. He was the commander of Central Command, which is military activity in the Middle East, while I was the NATO commander with responsibility for Europe, the near Middle East, Afghanistan. So Jim Mattis knows it very well. He has the Germans would say, the finger touch for the area. On the other hand, I'm very concerned, and in particular, if we can go back to the maritime sphere, about the implications for this in the Persian Gulf or Arabian Gulf, same body of water, two different names. Because if this turns into a confrontation at sea, and let's recall the Saudis are actually blockading Qatar at this point, which has to have incoming shipments of food, this could turn into a maritime dispute. And that's important, Jane, because that's what causes friction and shuts down the Strait of Hormuz, through which an enormous amount of oil flows. So there's a maritime component. I talk about this in Sea Power quite a bit in that Persian Arabian Gulf.
What about the Islamic State? They made inroads in Iran this week for the first time with a pair of attacks on two of Iran's most prominent symbols, the National Parliament, the mausoleum for the Ayatollah Khomeini. This, of course, after London, after Manchester. Speak to ISIS, this new strategy going to Iran. What are your thoughts?
First of all, you need to look at the movie of the Islamic State, not the snapshot of the latest attack. And the movie is very disturbing, Jane. It starts about 2 years ago, Russian airliner shot down, full of civilians, the Paris attacks year and a half ago, Lebanon market bombing here in the United States, Pulse nightclub, 55 dead, the largest mass shooting in the United States, three attacks in London, truck attack in France, truck attack in Sweden, Coptic church shot up in Egypt. This is a sweep of global terrorism that is starting to approach in numbers 9/11. It's not going to stop anytime soon, particularly if we try to deal with only the symptoms, which is playing defense at home. We need to go to Raqqa. We need to go to Mosul. That's Iraq and Syria, and root out the headquarters, the command and control of the Islamic State. That's a military operation. Then we've got to play the long game to try and bring the adherents away from this radicalized vision of Islam. Both of those have to happen. We're not there yet. We'll be dealing with the Islamic State for quite a while.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron, knowing that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. They follow the highest quality standards and deliver recipes along with just the right amount of ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created each week, so you can customize your recipes each week. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/onpoint. You don't have to spend time at the grocery store. Make great meals in under 40 minutes. There's no commitment, so pick what you want at blueapron.com/OP.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're speaking with retired Admiral James Stavridis, former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO this hour, about our NATO allies, about how we should engage with them and the rest of the world going forward. He's got a great new book. It's called Sea Power, The History of Geopolitics of the World's Oceans, and you can join the conversation. Is the United States moving away from its role as global leader? During Saturday's terror strike in London, an Italian photographer recorded events as British police chased and then killed the attacker in the streets near London Bridge. Here is the sound of his recording, which aired on NBC News.
Police are shooting. I'm trying to keep myself safe.
Here's more people running out of this situation.
Well, we can talk about London, we can talk about Tehran and Qatar and Syria, just to name a few of the hotspots around the world. Admiral, are we in a destabilized time, or does it just seem that way?
I think it seems that way more than perhaps it is at a certain level. Let's kind of look back 100 years ago. Where's the world? We're in the middle of World War I. 20 million people are going to die. We're going to stagger out of that into the Spanish influenza. Millions more will die. We'll have a global depression, then a second world war. 60 million people are going to die. So we're vastly better than that. And I'd refer many of the viewers to Steven Pinker's wonderful book, Our Better Angels, about the decrease in violence over the centuries as they go by. But it feels very real to us for two reasons. One is because of the transparency, the immediacy, the 24-hour news cycle, the immediate unpackaging of these events in very dramatic terms right in front of us in real time. And secondly, because there is less stability, I would argue, than perhaps 20 years ago in the immediate aftermath of the fall of the wall. We are now seeing the rise of other superpowers, China principally, Russia, et cetera, that's putting more tension into the mix than we saw 20 years ago. And third and finally, a group like the Islamic State can tap into all this technology, use it quite effectively, bringing those two threads together. Mm-hmm. So it feels, I think, more dangerous than it actually is. But it's not a comfortable feeling as you analyze international events.
Let me get Robert in here from Lincoln, Nebraska. Hi, Robert. You're on the air with Admiral James Stavridis. Go ahead.
Hi, Admiral. My question is, how would you mitigate the ISIS that is, basically coming off of the Pakistan side of the Afghan border? And what do you see that we could do for future, make peace with the Pakistanis and the Afghans?
Robert, thank you. Admiral?
Yeah, wonderful question, and highlights another element of the Islamic State's rise and continue to spread laterally around the world. They're very active in Afghanistan today, as Robert correctly points out. Let me give you three ideas quickly about how to deal with the Islamic State. First is the hard power instrument. You need it to go into Raqqa, Syria, into Mosul. We're not going to negotiate with the leadership of the Islamic State. We're going to have to find them and take them on militarily. That's not going to be another Iraq or Afghanistan with 100,000 U.S. troops, but we'll need around 10,000 U.S. troops with our allies and partners. Second, we need to cut off the financing. They are a money-making machine. They are still quite capable in cyber criminal activity and smuggling hydrocarbons and human trafficking and selling artifacts. We need to cut off the money. And then thirdly, the long game we have to play is strategic communications. We have to get into these social networks. We have to cut off their ability to recruit proselytize and attract young people to their cause. If we did those three things, we'd gradually compress them, but we shouldn't kid ourselves. This is the work, if not of decades, certainly of years to come. Mm.
Robert, thanks so much for the call. To this point, Admiral, you know, you have been very busy. You've written this book, Sea Power. You've also recently published a book called The Leader's Bookshelf. I know you also have a passion for innovation. You're a student of innovation. Talk for a moment about disruptive technologies and military defense and what the U.S. military needs to do to innovate, given the realities of a new kind of terrorism, ISIS, Islamic, you know, and the changing face of warfare that it's bringing with it.
Sure. I'm a proponent of thinking creatively about things and using literature to do so. So I'll give you a book that I think says a lot about innovation, and it's an old-time book that you may have read as a teenager. It's Mark Twain's A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. Here's a scientist and engineer, 19th century, who magically goes back 1,000 years into the past, into King Arthur's time. He's the smartest man in the world, right? He knows how to do everything. He's carried all that knowledge back with him, but he can't convince anybody, even though he has all the right answers. That's the struggle of innovation, is being that one person who has a brilliant idea and trying to convince a large, uncaring, and relatively uninformed world. So what should the U.S. military do? We should create innovation cells, small numbers of people working directly for top decision makers, give them small budgets to interact with the private sector to find the good ideas and move them rapidly through the decision cycle. This is something the Pentagon is dipping its toe in out with Silicon Valley. Those innovation cells become a link to private sector activity. And we have so many brilliant people in the private sector who want to come up with new ideas to help us. And then thirdly, I'll give you three areas to focus on. It's unmanned vehicles and artificial intelligence. The second is cyber and cyber activity. And the third is empowering special forces, small elite units. That's where the upswing in real innovation can come for our military.
Mm-hmm. Artificial intelligence, cyber, and empowering special forces. Mm. I've heard you say that 9/11 is not a failure of intelligence. It was a failure of imagination. So to your mind, seeing the world as you do and the experience as you've had, what are the biggest vulnerabilities out there? What keeps you up at night, Admiral?
I'm going to drag us back to the oceans of the world because – and I'm going to bring terrorism into this because we've seen terror come at us in the sky, 9/11, yeah. Blowing up airliners. We've seen terror come at us from the land, truck bombs. Where they have not gone is at sea. The vulnerabilities are big cruise liners. Think about the havoc that could be wreaked by a terrorist takeover of a cruise liner or an attack, suicide attack, small boat blowing up the side of one, sinking one of those mega cities at sea, or at the really dark end of the spectrum, Kim Jong-un, North Korea, he's probably not going to launch a nuclear weapon at us on a ballistic missile because we're going to know where it came from. He's going to park it in a container in a huge merchant ship and drive it into Long Beach Harbor. Those are the kinds of imaginative acts that, unfortunately, I think keep me awake at night.
So speak to that. How safe are our ports? Could we, you know, a container into Long Beach Harbor? Holy cow.
Our ports are not effectively safe, mainly because of volume. There are huge numbers of containers that move. As I mentioned, 50,000 ships at sea. And here's another disturbing aspect of this. It's the drug cartels who are experts at doing what? At smuggling loads into the United States, many by sea and semi-submersibles. I caught one when I was the Southern Command commander. We caught a semi-submersible cartel boat, looked like Batman's submarine, with 10 tons of cocaine in it. Now, if you can put 10 tons of cocaine in the hull, do you think you can put a weapon of mass destruction? Yes. Think of it as two streams. The North Korean regime building nuclear weapons, if they really want to get one here, they can contract it to a drug cartel. It's a far-fetched scenario, but it's the use of imagination that I don't think we should underestimate on the part of our opponents.
Admiral James Stavridis, talk about cyber warfare. You've testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee about this, about Russia, North Korea, China, and other nations launching sophisticated attacks against the United States. Of course, we've seen what Russia has done, meddling in our election process. Has the U.S. been too sheepish in its efforts to strike back in this arena?
Yes, we have highly capable offensive cyber tools that we could use to retaliate, to create a deterrent regime. But we've been very cautious about deploying them. And I understand the logic of that, which is, A, you don't want to reveal your capabilities on the offensive side. And B, it could be destabilizing. If you do X in response to the Y that came in, well, maybe they'll do Z, and all of a sudden you're in an upwardly destructive cycle in cyber. And our world is very vulnerable, notably here in the United States, our electric grid, but also our financial sector, our transportation sector, our medical sector, all are quite vulnerable. So here's what we need to do, Jane. We need to negotiate. We need to sit down with China and Russia, who have similar, highly capable offensive cyber tools. And just as we did in the Cold War, negotiate a regime of deterrence, of mutual deterrence. You don't use your offensive weapons, we won't use ours. Becomes much more a defensive play against cyber criminals, against smaller nations, much less concerning than the idea of Russia, China, the United States heading into a significant conflict in cyberspace. That is very worrisome and is the other thing that keeps me awake at night. Mm.
Admiral James Stavridis, you've spent almost 11 years of your life, 11 years of your life at sea in the United States Navy. What do you miss most about life out there?
I miss an office with a really good view. You would wake up in the morning and walk up to the bridge and have a cup of coffee and watch the sun come up. I miss looking philosophically at the ocean and knowing that I was seeing the same ocean that Christopher Columbus saw 500 years before, or that the admiral at Salamis, Themistocles, saw as dawn broke in the battle with the Persians. I miss that continuity of being a sailor at sea. But I'll tell you what I don't miss. I don't miss the fact that I was away for so many of my daughter's birthdays, so many of my anniversaries, so many Christmases. That's the price you pay for the right to serve, and I'm glad to have served. But I don't miss that part as much as I do miss the actual physical act of being a sailor at sea.
About a minute left here, Admiral. What would you leave us? What thought would you leave us with from your new book, Sea Power, about geopolitics of the oceans and how they influence events ashore?
Two thoughts. It's trade that moves around the world. It's the environment, which we have not spoken enough about in this hour. I'll come back and do it. And it is the geopolitical advantage of our allies around us. That's the challenge of the seas. And sea power matters for American power in all those dimensions.
Admiral James Stavridis, thank you for your extraordinary service. Former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, now Dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. His new book is called Sea Power, The History and Geopolitics of the World's Oceans. Admiral, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much, sir, for your time today.
My pleasure talking to you, Jane. All the best.
Thank you. In a moment, Nigerian author Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie tells new Williams College grads to commit to social justice. We'll have that in just a moment. This is On Point. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie is a MacArthur Grant-winning writer, author of the celebrated novel Americana. She spoke on Sunday at the commencement ceremony at Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts. She urged the new graduates to fight injustice. You cannot afford to be complacent, she said, because democracy is always fragile.
When the Nigerian government passed a ridiculous law that aimed to punish Nigerian citizens for being gay, I spoke up against it. An acquaintance told me that he didn't understand why I wouldn't just be quiet about it. You have nothing to gain, but everything to lose, he said. But I did have something to gain. Living in a just society is a huge gain, not merely in moral terms, although those are terribly important, but also in practical terms. Your productivity and your well-being increase if you live in a system of justice. You're better off if your fellow citizens are better off. When I talk about standing for social justice, I mean some of the obvious things, such as voting, helping others register to vote, calling your elected officials, actually knowing who your elected officials are, paying attention to local politics. And by the way, I'd like to digress a bit and implore all the political science graduates here to please change the structure of American politics. Please work to drastically shorten campaign cycles. Please work to remove the soul-destroying influence of money. Please work to make this democracy truly democratic. But sometimes, standing for social justice can mean listening, truly listening. Be open to anyone who does not wish you harm. American politics is so deeply tribal now that a common response is to demonize the other side. I won't ask you to never demonize a person with an opposing view because, quite frankly, some views deserve to be demonized. But don't make demonization your first option. Listen first. Hear what is being said. Engage with it. Gauge it. Then form your opinion. To stand for social justice is in many cases to be uncomfortable. Please be willing to be uncomfortable. You might squirm a bit. You should squirm a bit because nobody really enjoys being uncomfortable. But be uncomfortable. Discomfort can breed resilience. Discomfort can open up new understanding and meaning and knowledge.
That is Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie speaking to graduates at Williams College on Sunday. For a video of her address, go to our website, onpointradio.org. And thank you for being with us today. I'm Jane Clayson. Tom returns to us tomorrow. This is On Point.